Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, we are recording. Would you introduce yourself to posterity, and tell us what year you were born, where you were born, things like that?
Okay, my name is Truman Graf. I'm an emeritus professor at University of Wisconsin, College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. Also an extension specialist. I had a three-way appointment, teaching, research, and extension. I was born on a dairy farm up in Manitowoc County, 1922, a long time ago. I'm 87 years old, and so at any rate, I grew up in this farm. We had a very serious, well, I should say, a 100% tragedy. When I was 4 years old, my mother was killed in an automobile accident.
Oh, no.
So at any rate, that changed my life completely. Who knows what would have happened if she'd have been living, but I might still be back on the farm. So at any rate, I went to New Holstein. Well, I graduated from a one-room schoolhouse in Manitowoc County, town of Eaton. And then I went up to New Holstein High School. There's a story to that, too. In those days, the superintendent used to drive around the country looking for people to come to school, you know.
So my dad. Not all farm boys went to high school?
Oh, at that time? No, that's right. Well, actually, I grew up in a German community, and there were a lot of kids that started grade school that couldn't speak English. And they finished grade school not speaking very good English. But at any rate, in my family, my mother had been a teacher, so it was always imbued in us kids and we kids that we should get an education. And so I zipped through 8 grades okay there in a country school. And that was an interesting experience, too, because you sit in this little school with maybe 25, 30 kids in the school, and you got all 8 grades, and you're sitting there doing your stuff. In the meantime, the second grade, the third grade, and the eighth grader going through their materials. So you observe a lot of things in your head, you know, that you've been knowing about it.
So you knew what was coming for you later down.
Yeah. Plus, I don't know, you just sort of, it's an osmosis process where you're doing your own thing, but you hear all these other things going on. And so at any rate, there wasn't any big problem getting through grade school, but as I say, my dad, my brother and I were out in the field one day. I guess I was in seventh grade. And so lo and behold, somebody's driving down the road, and he stopped out there in the road, and I saw this fellow get out of the car, come up and talk to my dad. And after a while, he left, and I said, oh, what was that all about? And he said, oh, he's the superintendent up at New Holstein High School, and he was wondering if I wanted to go up to school there when I graduated from grade school. So my dad had told him, yeah, I guess that'd be right, because we were close to Chilton, we were close to Keele, and we were close to New Holstein, about 5 miles from each, and I could have gone either one. So again, I end up in New Holstein, which again was kind of a little quirk of fate, because when I got through high school, lo and behold, my grades were good enough, so I got a scholarship here to come to university.
Can we go back a little bit to the farm you grew up in?
Sure.
I'd also want to hear more about the high school. But tell us about your dad's farm. How big was it? How many cows? Was your dad a progressive farmer?
I think he was fairly progressive at the time, although I do have to confess that after my mother died, it probably changed him considerably, too. So he wasn't probably doing a lot of things he would have done if she'd have been around. I mean, he was raising a couple of kids, and, you know, it changed him around. But he was, well, actually, we were one of the first people up there to get electricity. So generated, you know, we generated right on the farm. And we also pumped our own air, so we had running water and all that kind of thing. And so, you know, we were living in a pretty good situation, although the times are really tough at the later on.
The late 1920s,
in the Depression,
for sure.
Yeah.
Do you remember how many cows, let's say,
how
many cows did
you have? We had about 20 cows or so, and, and well, we did have a milking machine, and he used to use the milking machine, and my brother and I would milk by hand. So that's how I learned how to milk cows at 4 or 5 years old.
My goodness. Really, did you milk every day?
Oh, yeah, every morning, every night, yeah. After a while, it got to be a drag. When I was young, of course, I thought, God, I want to get in there and start milking. Well, after I milked a while, I wasn't that crazy about it anymore. But at any rate, you'd have to get up early in the morning. It was cold outside and go down there. And of course, these cows are nice and warm, so you could lean up against them. And that's kind of nice, you know.
Did you, were you, when you were a boy, were you afraid of the cows? Were you comfortable with them?
Oh, no, I was always comfortable. I mean, you get to be comfortable with animals, yeah, like horses. We had horses, and we had hogs, and we had chickens, and we didn't have sheep, but, you know, we had everything. Yeah, we had about 20, 25 cows, and we sold our milk to, actually, to the Carnation Company in Chilton.
Really?
At that time, they were still making evaporated milk, and that was one of the outlets. But then later, and we can get into it more, then the cooperatives came along, and then eventually we started selling to them,
Was your herd registered cattle or?
No, it was Holsteins. It was Holsteins.
But registered Holsteins?
No, they were not. They were not. Okay. Right.
So your father wasn't necessarily into making money on selling stock.
No, he didn't have that kind of money. No, now he. That's another thing. Like I say, he might have gotten into purebreds and all that if my mother had been around. One of my uncles was very big. In purebreds, that sort of thing. We had, you know, fairly good cows, but I wouldn't say they were out of this world or anything.
Was your father on test? Did he keep track of production and butterfat and so forth?
Yeah, we would get the production records and the fat records. And, of course, again, he wasn't on DHIA, so he probably wasn't quite as vigilant in terms of individual cows, but he pretty much knew which cows were doing the job, which weren't. I can still remember, you know, you just knew a lot of these cows. They had a lot of milk, and the test was pretty good. And so, you know, you kind of knew which cows were which. But and, of course, in a herd of 20 or 25, you can do that. In a herd of 1,000, you know, you need seven more than that.
Exactly. Yeah, so. Do you think your father and you, as you got older, became interested in getting more out of each cow, or was it kind of, gee, this is okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was... That was necessary if you didn't get anything more out of each cow. Matter of fact, we were typical of farms in those days. When the Depression came along in 1929, we would have frankly lost that farm if it hadn't been for the federal land grant program, where you could borrow money from the government at a low interest rate and get some deferment on the principal and then gradually pay it off over time.
Wow.
And, you know, we weren't any different than the other farmer. A lot of them were in the same straits at the time. And so at any rate, he managed to weather that that terrible problem with the Depression. It ran from 1929 through 1933, and it was still not really very good on the farm all the way up to World War II.
Right.
There were some ups and downs. And then you had the drought in 1934 and in 1936, a terrific drought. Very, very little production you were getting. Didn't really have enough feed for the animals. I can still remember that very vividly. That, one year I think we got 400 or 500 bushels of grain that we harvested. Normally we'd be getting 3,000, 4,000 bushels.
Wow.
So, you know, it was terrible. The 34 and 36 were really, really rough. And those are the days of the Sun Bowl down in Kansas and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Was your dad buying things off the farm, or was it pretty much whatever you utilized, whatever you had, whatever you had on the farm? Was he buying grain? Was he buying fertilizer?
Well, he would buy fertilizer because, you know, well, okay, let's start over.
Yeah.
With all those cows, you had a lot of manure, and so you would, you know, use that for fertilization. Of course, again, in those days, that technology was not nearly as advanced as it is today, so a lot of the nutrients never got out into the fields. For instance, in the wintertime, you'd have a manure pile out in the back of the barn. You'd haul the manure out of the barn, dump it on the manure pile, it lay there, and then in the spring, you know, you'd haul it around to the fields. By that time, a lot of the nutrients had disappeared.
Oh.
So, but at any rate, we used the manure. He also bought some fertilizer. Our farm was like a lot of farms in those days. It was fairly self-sufficient because you were raising producing not only milk from the dairy cattle, you had, we had some soybeans, we had some canning peas, we had some sugar beets, we had some oats, some barley, some wheat, winter wheat at times. You know, see, we're doing a little bit of everything, which, of course, is not the way it is now. Today, everything's specialized. But, so you, and we did some bartering of things. I remember we used to go into town on Saturday night, and we'd haul in some eggs and get some credit at the grocery store, and that sort of thing. So it was a general purpose farm, but majoring mostly in dairying.
I'm kind of curious why it is that farmers in your area and around in Wisconsin got into trouble in the Depression. Did they owe money on the land and the barn? Were they borrowing money for something?
Mostly the former. Mm-hmm. Now, for instance, in my dad's case, he had borrowed some money from the bank. He had borrowed some money from an individual, mm-hmm. a financier. And of course let's start over again. My great grandparents came over from Germany in 1848.
Wow.
And they hacked out a living up there, had to clear the land and just started from scratch. And then my grandfather took over after my great grandfather retired and left the scene. And then eventually my dad took over. Well, by that time, my grandfather had I think, seven or eight children. So, of course, you know, with my dad taking over, he wasn't just going to get a farm scot-free. You know, you had to satisfy the estate. So he did borrow money to buy the farm from
his siblings.
Right, yeah. And that was going along fairly well until the Depression hit. And then all of a sudden, the income dropped way off. And they're having trouble paying the interest, had trouble paying the principal. But as I say, fortunately, these government programs came along, and he was able to survive until at least the income started to pick up again.
Now, your grandfather or your father's siblings, brothers and sisters, they didn't want to stay on the farm or in neighboring farms?
Well, the way it was in those days, and to a certain extent it's that way, at least overseas in some of the countries, the oldest sibling had first crack at it. And my brother had my dad had several older brothers, but one of them decided to go to Milwaukee to be an electrician, and another one ended up down in Florida, and I'm not sure what he was doing down there. But at any rate, so then it got down to my dad's turn, and my dad's younger brother also, his name was Waldo Grove, he also would have been very happy to have taken the farm over, but my dad had first crack at it, so he took it. So then his younger brother, Uncle Waldo, bought a farm about 5 or 6 miles away. So that's how it worked in those days.
That's how it worked.
Yeah.
And were people looking to acquire more land at that period also? In other words, did your dad feel he needed more land at that stage in his career?
And that's another reason why he had some debts. The home farm itself was 88 acres. It was all in one piece. But then, somewhere along the line, and this must have happened before I was born, there were 20 acres available about a mile away, right across from the cemetery. And so he bought those 20 acres, which were very fertile land, very, very good land. The home farm itself was okay, but maybe 60-70% was productive. The rest of it was in creeks and hills and trees and all that kind of thing. And then he eventually bought another 40 acres down by the swamp. And there again, and there was about 10 acres or so that was okay to grow stuff on, which we did. And then the rest of it was swamp and woods. We used to make wood and all that kind of thing. So that's one way that some of these debts piled up, by having to buy another 20 acres, another 40 acres, which again would have been good investments until all of a sudden, you know, you couldn't get anything for your produce anymore. And of course, with the drought coming along on top of it, that really was kind of the kiss of death. So at any rate, that was sort of the history of that farm.
And do I assume that your father had a silo on the farm?
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
Grandfather as well.
Yeah, we had a silo, right? We had one silo. Yeah.
Okay.
So we'd make silage every year. Yeah, you hit the corn and chop it up and blow it up in the silo.
Doing crop rotations.
Sort of informal. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't grow corn continuously. You had to shift it around with the hay, and the same thing with the grain. You'd plant barley for a couple of years, then you'd put it into pasture, and, or you'd put it into alfalfa, and maybe cows would graze on it, but you make hay out of it. So we were cutting hay and, of course, hauling it into the barn, storing it for the winter. We were doing the same thing with the grain. You'd have threshing crews every summer. I remember that very vividly.
Those were supposedly very entertaining.
Oh,
very
well,
social
it,
and
yeah, well, it, when the threshing crew came to your farm, yeah, it was a big deal because all the neighbors, you know, would cooperate, and you would help the neighbors out, and they would help you out. So you had a, first of all, you had to get the grain cut and shocked, which you did maybe a week ahead of time, get it shocked up, and then the threshing crew would come, and you'd have all these wagons, and you go out in the field and pick up all these shocks, bring them in and run them through the threshing machine, and blow the straw up into the mow, and then use the grain, you know, put that into the granary.
How would you make the shocks? Did you do that by hand?
Hold on, the binders would.
The binders.
The binders would.
And who owned the binder? Did your father?
Yeah, we had the binder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what machinery would he have owned, you know, good machinery would he have owned?
Well, just about everything that he needed on the farm. You'd have we had two tractors. We had a farm mow, and we had a GI case. The farm mow was an older tractor, and there's a story to that. Boy, that thing was hard to start in the wintertime. You'd crank and crank and crank, dump hot water over the radiator. But at any rate, you had two tractors. We had the binder. We had a lot of plows. We had a plow for the tractor, you know, it had three or four plows on it, but then we had a single plow behind the horses. And, of course, the kids would have to handle that on the horses, you know, and that could be kind of tricky, driving these horses and you're trying to keep that plow straight, you know.
Would you walk behind them?
Oh, yeah, you walk behind the plow, yeah. With the horses, in the tractor, you'd sit up on the seat,
of course.
And the plow would be behind you, but, yeah, with the horses, you get the horses and you're walking along, and you had to plow a straight furrow. Boy, if you didn't plow a straight furrow, you were in big trouble.
Dad get mad at you?
Well, yeah, he'd ball you out once in a while.
Did you take pride as you grew older in doing a straight furrow?
Oh, yeah, you. That was built into you. You better do right, that stuff right, or else you got big trouble coming down the pike.
Now, why would he use a one bottom plow when he had the tractor, just to keep you guys busy?
Well, no, you get it done quicker that way, you know.
Just more out there.
Yeah, as long as you had the horses and the kids are on, you might as well use everything. Yeah.
And how did you cut hay? He must have had some kind of a what do you call it? A mower, right?
On
his tractor.
Yeah, for the grain, of course, you had the binder. And mm-hmm. it had the sickles on it.
Mm-hmm.
You go down the row, it would cut the grain, flip it up into a platform, it would run it up over the top of some pulleys. Then you had the binder twine attachment that as the grain would come down the platform, it would get jammed up where the binder twine was, and would wrap a bundle and kick it out, and then the other stuff would come in. So what you ended up with was you had all of these these individual parcels of grain scattered down the field, and then after you got done cutting it, then you'd have to go down and you'd pick these up and put them into a shock. So
put them up by hand?
Well, yeah. They'd be just dumped. As the binder went along, you'd dump this one, and you'd dump that one, you'd dump that one. So then you'd go behind it. Usually, you know, one person would run the binder, and then maybe my dad ran the binder, and then my brother and I would go along behind and just pick up these bundles and put them. Usually had 6 to 8 in a shock. We would pick up two, put them together, pick up another two, pick up another two, pick up another two, and then you'd have one shock with eight shocks in them, and then you go along the line. So then when you get all done, you had all these shocks all over the field, and then later on at threshing time, the wagons would go down between the rows, and you'd have some people on one side of the wagon, some on the other side. They'd pick these shocks up, flip them into the wagon, bring them home. And then again, you had to get those lined up. You just didn't throw them all on top of each other, because it was easier to pick them off if you had one row on one side of the wagon and one row on the other.
Right.
And so then when you were up at the threshing machine, you weren't just hacking around trying to pull stuff out of a big pile. You got individual kind of lines there that you could pull them out of. So that was kind of the procedure.
And do you recall hating this work, liking this work, or being indifferent to this work?
Well, eventually, I mean, you didn't really think about not doing it because you just didn't think of that. That was something you did.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, you know, you got to admit that, well, I have to admit that, and especially on weekends, you know, I'd go to high school during the week, and then on weekends the kids up in town would be goofing around, and I'd be out working all the time. So, you know, that kind of bugged you a little bit, but you didn't really think much about it.
That reminds me, did kids in town make fun of the farmer kids?
To a certain extent, yeah. Oh, he's a farm kid, you know. Big raw-boned farm kid.
And what did you say? The heck, we're better than you are? Or did you feel insecure?
No, well, in a way, after a while, you just, I mean, it was just something you live with and didn't get too excited about it.
Well, when were you doing this work? I take it you're working with your brothers and your sisters as well?
No, we just had two boys.
You just had, the boys, okay. Mm-hmm. Did you tell jokes, tell stories, just normal high school type conversation? Did you have things you talked about?
I wouldn't say that we spend too much time socializing. Usually working.
And was there any pride in that particular job, like the plowing you mentioned and how you liked the straight furrow? Or was it just get the darn thing done?
Pretty much the latter.
Okay. Now, I want you to look back as a man who knows an awful lot about cows and agriculture today. Mm-hmm. Okay, so looking from 70 years in the future. What was that farm all about? I mean, how did it do financially? And what were its efficiencies and what were its inefficiencies? You know, how would you write it up today?
I would say at that time it was more a matter of just making a living, period. Doing what you had to do to make a living.
Uh-huh.
Later on, of course, as economic conditions improved. Matter of fact, eventually my dad sold that farm to a neighbor.
Hmm.
After the kids were out, we went down to college. And so after the war, when things were pretty good, then he did sell the farm and went out to California to work. The neighbor then probably did more of the modern stuff on that farm than we were doing, because, again, at that time it was pretty much, well, like I say, it was an all-purpose farm where you were doing everything under the sun, which nowadays is verboten. I mean, now you specialize in something and try to really get good in that.
Uh-huh.
So,
and there's some kind of a line that maybe happened after the war. Mm-hmm. So before you were just trying to survive and make a living.
Pretty much
then
survive.
What happened? What's the new mentality that begins to dawn on farmers?
I think it was pretty much World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, World War II turned everything around, because all of a sudden then there was money available. And like I say, we had been more or less struggling to just stay afloat until World War II, and then the incomes went up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, as a matter of fact, I can remember before the war that we were getting, I still remember that one milk check, it was 77 cents a hundredweight. You know, 77 cents a hundredweight.
Whoa.
And you know, even though you're raising a lot of your own things, and you still got to buy all kinds of stuff. You got to buy the gas, and you got to buy fertilizer, and you got to buy the seed, and you got to buy all kinds of stuff. You can't just expect it to grow on its own, you know. And so at any rate, it was pretty much just day in and day out, you know, you get some money in and you pay it out. And so you were paying your interest, paying your principal, and gradually at least getting partially back on your feet, but nevertheless you weren't really, you know, building up any retirement income or anything like that.
It's
then during the war, prices went up substantially, and you're ending up getting $2-3 a hundredweight, and got up to $4 a hundredweight, and so all of a sudden you're getting, $4 compared to one, you know, that's 400% increase, you know, and that, of course, you aren't going to get rich on it, but at least you can start getting your head above water a little bit. So then after the war, when he sold it to a neighbor, then, of course, they were getting more specialized and converted it strictly into a dairy farm, got the cows registered, put it on the federal milk order, and, you know, things like that, and then things were somewhat better.
Did they become, the new owners, more efficiency-minded than your father perhaps was? Was your father efficiency-minded?
Oh, I'm sure he was.
Was he?
He was. I mean, he wasn't stupid by any means.
No.
He was a pretty smart guy.
Was he profit-minded?
Oh yeah, well, of course you had to be in those days.
Right, okay.
If you weren't, you wouldn't be around. But because of the nature of the farm, where you're raising everything under the sun, you know, you'd make a little on this, like on the canning peas. I mean, you know, we have canning peas every summer. The canning company would come around, and well, they give you the seed, and then you'd plant it, and then eventually they'd come around and cut it and haul it into the canning company. Huh. And well, there you were under a disadvantage. It's part of this whole co-op principle. The canning company told you when to cut it, and they told you how much they're going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. And it was always this battle, because if you let the peas go too long, they get kind of hard, and you get them downgraded. But you get more pounds, but you get them downgraded, so the price is lower. Mm-hmm. If they're going to cut them too green, well, then you get more water in them, you get a little more weight, but you don't have near as many pounds as you would before.
Right.
And then on top of it, you never know what the price is going to be. So you're more or less at the mercy of the canning company, but nevertheless, you get a little money out of canning peas. Mm-hmm. Same thing on sugar beets. You can play sugar beets, and I still remember how I used to, you know, you had to get down and thin all those sugar beets out. You'd plant them in a row, broadcast them in a row, and then you'd have to get down later when they're growing up and just take out, you know, you'd have one plant every 6 inches or so, so you'd have to clear them out. So you're down on your hands and knees going down this row to clear these sugar beets out.
Wow.
And, you know, I can still feel my back aching from that. But, but at any rate, that was another source of income. And so you did all these little things to try to make some kind of money. But my dad, you know, he knew, I think just like farmers generally in those days, they knew how to do stuff, but perhaps they didn't have all the training. They certainly didn't have all the training that modern farmers had.
Right, but they were sort of improvement-minded to some degree.
Yeah, they farmers are very ingenious, you know. They have to know stuff. I mean, if they don't know stuff, they won't be around long, so, yeah.
Dairying, I assume, again, on your dad's farm when you were in high school or so, was the principal cash income, yeah?
Was the what?
Was the most biggest source of cash income, dairy.
Well, it was milk, yeah.
Yeah, milk. And would you say that the cash income on the farm was greater than all the other income, stuff you ate yourself?
Yeah, it was a major industry. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Oh, right, okay.
Now, one thing about the farm in those days was, like I say, our home farm was kind of hilly, mm-hmm. and a fair amount of, there was a creek in it, which was a lot of land that wasn't really used very well because the creek was there, and in those days you didn't have all these environmental laws and everything you have now. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, you'd pasture some of this land along the creek, so there was a woods up there. We'd hack some trees out of there every winter for woods and all that kind of stuff. So that in itself, it wasn't just an 88-acre farm that you could plant every year and put it into alfalfa and harvest that and use that for the feed and all that. You had all of these sort of inhibiting factors. So that was partly, you know, for instance, the sugar beets. The reason we had sugar beets is we had a drainage problem on about 5 acres of land down at the end by the road. And every spring that would flood. Mm. And it would get very moist down there. And so you couldn't really have a lot of crops like barley and wheat and oats and all that kind of stuff down there because you could never get them going. So we used that for sugar beets.
Ah.
It worked real good for sugar beets because they needed the moisture, and you could get them in fairly early without hurting them, because even though the ground was quite moist, they would survive very nicely. So it was part of that, too.
What would a guy today on that land do with those 5 acres?
Well, you know, that's another point. My dad sold that farm after the war, and I go up there every once in a while, and now, my God, even though it's 5 miles from New Holstein, they've got about half of it rezoned. They got houses all over the place.
Gee, yes.
They're probably getting more money for one lot than he got for the whole farm. That's a problem when you aren't born at the right time.
It's never the right time.
Yeah. Well, for instance, that woods that we had up there, it was about 7 or 8 acres. And we used to, you know, harvest some trees out of it. Now it's prime real estate. God, that woods is filled with houses. And you can imagine the kind of price they're getting for those lots in that woods.
Would you say that your father was conservation-minded? You know what I mean? Was he influenced by the whole idea of conserving the soil and rebuilding it and so on?
I think he was quite conservancy minded in terms of trying to make a living, period. Mm-hmm. And like I say, we had some drainage problems in the farm. We had some hills in the farm. We had some sloping land in the farm. And you try to do things like put alfalfa down in key areas so it could impede the flow of the water, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He was looking at conserving his land and its value.
Yeah, right, right. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was looking at it. That was long before the days of Al Gore and, you know, in terms of ecology and all
right.
that, and Gaylord Nelson.
Right.
You know, they were trying to make a living, period.
Yeah. do you think he was thinking in advance, like, when you would take over the farm, or your brother, in other words, to conserve what he had for them.
He had sort of intended that I would take over the farm, because I don't know, somewhere along the line the idea seemed to develop that my brother was going to go on for his education, and then I think he kind of hoped that I would take the farm over. But when he approached me about it, I said, you know, and I knew I was just a kid, but I said, you know, I just don't think I want to do that. And so he didn't say no.
He didn't say no.
Yeah, he let me do what I wanted to do, yeah. If my mother had been around, I don't know what would have happened. Maybe I'd have still been on the farm, I don't know. But I just knew I didn't want to do that.
What is it you knew? I mean, what is it in your guts that told you
to... Yeah, I just knew in my guts that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life.
But what was the that you didn't want to do? I mean, I know it was farming, but what is about the that you didn't like?
I think, again, it must have been goes all the way back to when my mother was alive, that somehow or another I got in my head I wanted to get an education.
Well, because she was a teacher.
Yeah, she was a teacher. Yeah. She had a lot of... Well, and I shouldn't, you know, denigrate my dad and all my other relatives, but... They were all, you know, quite progressive people.
Yeah.
And even though now my dad only, well, I imagine he had an eighth grade education, but that was all. As most of the people did there.
Did he read farm magazines?
Oh, yeah, we had Hordes Dairyman and Wisconsin Agriculture.
You had all those things. Yeah.
And he's probably like most people, you know, you work all day and you get kind of tired at night. And you read for a while and you kind of fall asleep.
Did you have a radio, by the way?
Oh, yeah, we had a little radio, yeah.
Did you guys sit around the radio and listen?
I used to. Oh, you know, I was talking to you about that drought in 34 and 36.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Back in those days, you didn't have TV, of course, and the radio was really the only thing you got from the outside world.
Right.
Well, you had a newspaper.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But at any rate, I used to be a big, well, I still am to a certain extent, a baseball fan. And so, like in the noon hours, we'd come in from the field and maybe come in at 12 o'clock and have some lunch and maybe have a half an hour or so before we had to go out again. And in those days, the ball game started at noon, apparently.
Right.
So I used to sit there and listen to these ball games, you know, until I had to go out in the field again. And then, of course, you'd get interested. You're in this bottom of the fourth inning and somebody's on base. Come on, it's time to go out to the field. Oh, just one more inning.
Oh, wow. Well, I assume you were Chicago Cubs fans?
In those days, the Brewers weren't here yet.
Oh.
I was more a White Sox fan.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, for some reason
you
never...
You must have some kind of streak in you.
Yeah. Some reason I never get caught up to the Cubs.
I was talking to an old guy out in Coon Valley, and he recalls a Negro League team coming through to play the local group. Did you anything like that happen in your...
They came in once in a while,
yeah.
On an exhibition game. Yeah,
yeah. Was that cool?
Yeah. Actually, I think they came up to Keele once, and I remember the pit... I know in football that the Pittsburgh Steelers came into Keele one day, and we went up to watch that. My dad would... He was nice that way. Like, he took us to a Packer game once, and I think I went to one Packer game. I went to that game there in Keele, and I think a Negro baseball team came through.
Really?
Yeah. So.
Did you play baseball? Were you able to?
I played in high school. Yeah, I played in high school.
Yeah,
You play everything, baseball, basketball, football, everything.
I mean, just curious about the kinds of things that farm boys could do for recreation.
And yeah, well, that was another thing. Like I say, we would be out in the country. We'd drive into town to go to school. Then after school, you'd have baseball or football or basketball practice. And you could do that. But then as soon as you get done with it, you tear home so you can milk the cows and feed them and clean up the place. And so, you know, you're busy all the time. So.
Did you ever feel that your father wished he had more of your labor?
Well, I mean, we worked all the time. There was always work. I mean, there were no two ways about it. You didn't think about it. You know, there was always something to do around the farm. Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you a bit about your neighbors back in those days, mm-hmm. especially the colorful neighbors. I mean, the people who, you know, these big personalities or crazy guys or something. Anybody stand out in your mind?
Well, there was one neighbor. He wasn't exactly a neighbor. He was right next to that country school. Uh-huh. And he lived back in the woods, and those were the days of the Prohibition. And so the story was, you know, that this guy's got a still back there. So I still remember one day we saw an airplane, a little Piper Cub, I guess it was, circling around, and kids were all out looking, oh yeah, he's a revenue agent, he's trying to find where the smoke is coming up from the still. So then I don't know if they raided him or not, but I think they ended up raiding him because that could be a big story. Yeah.
What about, were there any farmers in the neighborhood who stood out as being particularly forward-minded?
I think my Uncle Waldo was uh-huh. more forward-minded because, like I say, he ended up with registered Guernseys. Mm. And he was a very efficient farmer. He ended up being sort of involved in politics. He's on the county board,
okay.
and that sort of thing. Uh-huh. So there were, and then of course there were these farmers that got involved in organizing the Lake to Lake Cooperative. He was one of them.
Oh.
My dad was sort of along, but I mean he wasn't really one of the leaders in that thing. But yeah, there were farmers. Well, that's the way it advanced. You know, some of these farmers would get involved in something or other that they thought was perhaps going to help them and help their neighbors. And so there was always that going on. Then, of course, the county agent was helpful
yes.
too, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. So can we talk just for a minute about the beginnings of Lake to Lake and what people in your neighborhood thought about it, why these guys wanted to start a co-op? They were unhappy with Carnation?
Well, it wasn't just Carnation. Uh-huh. It was the whole setup at that time that it's kind of like the canning company example. You know, you had these companies that everybody is trying to maximize their own income, and if you don't have any competition, well, you're going to do what you can do. You're not going to be illegal about it, but you're going to try to have your prices as high to the consumer as possible and as low to the producer as possible. Mm-hmm. So on milk, you had this situation. It wasn't just in Wisconsin. It was all over the country. That the farmers were generally unorganized. They were all competing against each other for markets, so that the handlers, of course, not that they were just playing one against the other, but there wasn't any real pressure to do any raising because you had enough other farmers that had extra milk or were trying to maximize their income that they'd offer to sell it to them, and so on and on and on. So the whole farm economy was sort of depressed, and well, I shouldn't say sort of, it was depressed, period. And so as far as Lake to Lake is concerned, these farmers in Wisconsin especially, well, for one thing, they couldn't get onto the Chicago market for fluid because the Chicago market had kind of boxed themselves in or boxed it out, so nobody could get in there unless they played footsie with the authorities down there. And as individual farmers, they didn't really have much marketing power. But then on top of it, as I say, there was enough milk bouncing around looking for a market that all of the prices were quite low. And so then people like, I say, my Uncle Waldo and others, their fellow by the name of J.H. Murphy, who was Art Murphy, his name was Art Murphy, a very progressive guy, started working with the farmers trying to do something about improving this price situation. And I don't know if you remember the name Truman Torgerson or not.
I have his book here.
Yeah, right. His son wrote a book about him. Yeah. Well, at any rate, he was the county agent up in Manitowoc County at the time, and they were working with him. And so they were going around meeting with the farmers. And I can still remember some of those group meetings. I'd be just a kid, you know, sitting there listening, and the farmers would be sitting around. They had one meeting up in my uncle's living room. I still remember that. It's probably back in the late 20s, I suppose, and yeah, things are bad, we got to do something, and you know, it was always that, I remember at Elkhart Lake, we used to go there for these meetings, and farmers all sitting around, God, we got to do something, you know, they didn't know exactly what they were going to do.
But no one knew what, right?
Yeah, well, that's how these ideas get going,
yeah.
And it, eventually they got this thing organized, so they got enough people signed up to join this co-op, like Lake to Lake Co-op, that they could actually make it a formal organization, and then they were going to start procuring the milk. And
why did they think they could do better?
Well, because they felt, first of all, they'd have volume. Instead of you'd having 100 farmers with a couple thousand pounds apiece, you'd have all that milk, and so then first of all, you could perhaps find a better market for that milk when you had volume than the individual farmers could.
Okay.
Secondly,
by getting
the co-op organized, it would give an alternative to farmers instead of being more or less at the mercy of the, not just Carnation, but all these others that, you know, up to that time didn't have much competition, that they could bargain for somewhat higher prices. And so they eventually got this thing going, and then they got on the Chicago Milk Marketing Order for selling fluid milk. Instead of just being all grade B milk and get it on and have grade A milk, which had a higher price. And so the combination of all that, you know, ended up putting the farmers in a better bargaining
position. And it actually did.
Yeah, it did.
Well, okay, so they were getting a bit more for their milk.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, it improved their pricing. I mean, it still wasn't a bonanza, but at least it gave them some competitive position, yeah.
So they basically increased competition. By having another, and in this case, larger.
Right, by having a cooperative, yeah.
Right. Were the local cheesemakers private entrepreneurs, and for the most part, were there co-op cheese factories as well?
At that time, it was primarily, again, that was primarily private. They were private, and there were some little co-ops, but they would be, you know, little, kind of like the corner grocery store, you know. Matter of fact, we had a cheese factory right up the road from us, about 3/4 mile, and that was interesting too, because that factory at that time, you didn't have all these environmental regulations, so they would run all their way into a ditch, and this cheese factory was up the top of the hill, and then the whey would come down the hill right going by our farm. And I mean, I can still very vividly recall that smell of whey, because every morning you had all that whey there, and of course, especially in the summertime, it'd get a little sticky, you know.
But your dad decided not to be a patron of that factory. They weren't paying good enough, or
I'm not sure how he got started with Carnation, but we just always sold to Carnation. Probably could have sold to the cheese factory, although I assume the cheese factory probably wouldn't pay quite what Carnation was doing. But that was just a little private cheese factory, yeah. And there were a lot of those scattered around.
Now, if you don't mind, let's move on a little bit towards your leaving the farm and going to the university.
Sure.
And is there anything you want to cover that in your own notes first?
No, I just listed some of the stuff that...
Feel free.
Well, I listed various categories like the federal milk order system.
Yeah.
The milk price support system, dairy policy, dairy cooperatives, dairy marketing generally in terms of the distribution, dairy promotion, international trade. Those were all areas that impacted.
Okay. I have things in here. If I don't get to them, then feel free to.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I thought we'd go march through the decades a little bit.
Sure.
Send, get you into college first here.
Mm-hmm.
Did your father go to short course, by the way?
No, I don't think they, I'm not even sure they had short course. I don't think they did. No,
okay.
I think that came along after the war, I think.
And did you think of going to short course, or you were set on going to UW? I mean, for a 4-year.
Well, again, as I say, I don't know that there was short course in those days, yeah.
Oh,
no,
okay.
my idea at all, see, my brother ended up coming down to the university in, let's see, he came down in 1937. And he had been there 2 years when I graduated from high school. So at that time, you didn't have all these state colleges and all that, at least not in agriculture. So it was always just in my mind that if I went to college at all, I'd be down here to Madison.
And
then, of course, then when I got that scholarship, that cemented it. I also got a Sears Roebuck scholarship. So I had these two little scholarships. Well, at that time, it wasn't so little.
Uh-huh.
The Sears Roebuck scholarship, I think, was $75 as a scholarship, and and the university one was the free tuition. So, you know, that was...
Were those competitive scholarships because of your academic
Well, the scholarship one was because of my standing at high school.
High school,
The other one was just, you know, in terms of, you know, competing for it and So fortunately, I was one of the people picked.
I suppose $75 paid your room and board, right, for a semester or something?
In those days, $75 is a big amount.
I bet.
Yeah, it was a big amount, right. In two ways about it. Room and board, I started working as soon as I got down here. I mean, that was just part of the deal. You get a meal job or you get a... I worked in the YMCA and I worked in restaurants.
Where was the Y in those days?
It was down there. It's right next to Memorial Union.
There was a Y there, huh?
Yeah, it's right next to it. Yeah, where the parking lot is now. So between the Armory and the... And
oh,
the,
I see. Yeah. Uh-huh. It, when you came down to Madison, was you were set on an ag degree of some sort? You weren't.
That was the only. That was all I knew was agriculture. Yeah.
But your idea was to become educated and not return as a farmer, not to be an educated farmer.
I probably didn't think that far ahead, but I'm sure that was my idea. Yeah. Because I did. Otherwise, I could just. Well, in other words, I wasn't smart enough to know that if I went up down here and went back, I'd be a better farmer. I just didn't want to. At that time, I didn't want to be a farmer, period.
Well, let me ask you this. Was the concept of an intellectual farmer an oxymoron? I mean, could you conceive of yourself as being a thinking, learned person and a farmer?
I don't think that being a farmer really played very strongly in my mind. Okay. I didn't really know what it, well, I mean, who knew, as a 17-year-old kid, who knows what
right.
to do.
Right,
but I mean, I don't think I was coming down with the idea, hey, I'm going to get so smart I can go back and make a living on the farm.
Oh, that's what I guess I was asking. Okay. I want to talk about your intellectual progress at the university.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if, to the degree you can remember how your thinking changed, evolved, matured about about agriculture and its position in the country's economy.
Yeah, that was a result of my education. No two ways about it. I mean, as you get more and more educated and get more and more information and process it, I could. I mean, then of course, eventually you just get consumed by it. You know, you you. Constantly thinking of things that you can hopefully help with that will improve agriculture. That was kind of the gist of what my work at the university, at least what I was trying to do anyhow.
Did you have that in mind to improve agriculture? And that was what, I mean, obviously you wanted a career and so forth as a person, but did you wanted a career in making agriculture better?
Well, once I got into it, yeah.
Really?
Right,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did you have any, like, aha moments that you can remember where you went, oh, now I get it?
You mean in terms of my education?
I
had some of those. I guess one of the things that really stuck in my mind was after I graduated, and I decided to go to grad school, and I ended up being one of the top people I remember taking this master's exam, and I ended up having one of the highest scores, and I thought, you know, that's really something. I mean, it really made me feel good, yeah.
I guess it would have. Better than the straight, plowing a straight furrow,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
In those days, when you were young, PhD student or master's student, what did it look like ag needed? What were the challenges that you thought you and your colleagues could do to improve agriculture?
Well, I think all of these things that I just rattled off here in terms of these various categories, and of course at that time I wasn't, you know, I have to admit that I didn't, well, my God, I ought to have learned something when I worked 33 years or 35 years, but anyway, I didn't have it all paced out.
Oh, of course not.
In
took
my
it
mind,
step
you know,
by
but
step.
But you could see that there were things going on, well, like in milk pricing and
yeah,
in milk marketing and promotion and all those things. You could see they needed something to be done, and so hopefully you could make some contribution.
What was your critique of what was being done, and then what were your ideas for improving that?
Well, partly the fact that I grew up on a dairy farm and saw all of these problems firsthand, and grew up with them, and was kind of, was completely immersed in them.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, as I get more and more educated and more familiar and more involved in things, I could gradually, you know, pick up the bigger picture where I could say, well, maybe if we try this or we try that. So like I say, I was part research, part teaching, and part extension. And so you had all three components coming together at one time, and one would play off of the other. And so that's kind of how the whole process worked.
Yeah. So you came up with things like, you know, increasing the power of co-ops and milk. Let's talk about each of those as attempts to correct what the deficiencies of dairy agriculture. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about co-ops some more, if you will.
Well, it's kind of like I mentioned about when they formed Lake to Lake.
Yeah.
That's a story that was replicated, you know, many, many times over. I mean, it's just the issue of it's like in any industry, if you got a whole bunch of little unorganized entities that are competing in a large marketplace, you know, you're going to have limited bargaining power, limited pricing power.
Okay.
So that was the concept of cooperatives, and so that's how the whole cooperative movement was built on. And I guess Marcia mentioned that Bob Krepp had written up all kinds of stuff, and you know, he was involved in co-ops.
Uh-huh.
Well, actually, he was the director of the Center for Co-ops. But at any rate, the cooperative movement grew up out of this, and I think it was a very legitimate concern that if you, and of course, there was a lot of critics of co-ops. I mean, I can remember when I first started at university, and you'd go around to these meetings and have cooperative discussions and whatnot, and then you go out to talk to somebody at a private plant. I mean, God, what are you guys doing now? Are you plugging co-ops, you know? My God, what's going on down there? Well, that's not right, you know, on and on and on. So, I mean, it was that kind of an atmosphere. So.
Sometimes did it get a little scary? I mean, was people very exercised about it?
Well, they didn't exactly threaten to hit you or anything, but you know, the vocal response, you know, was pretty sharp.
Right.
I still remember going to one plant, I wouldn't even name where it is because you might know who it is, but I walked in to see this manager and, oh God, you're from university. I know I hear you've been working on co-ops, and God, I don't know, I want to talk to you or not. You know, it was that kind of stuff.
Did they see it as socialism?
Well, they felt that the co-ops were getting an unfair advantage because they weren't paying taxes on their earnings, so it was that kind of stuff.
Now,
of course, the co-op's response was that they aren't really earnings, they're all going back to the farmers. So,
right, you know, and the farmers have to pay income tax on those earnings. Were farmers universally interested in co-ops, or were there some farmers who didn't like the idea?
There were probably some that were... there weren't, I don't know, as a philosophy, I don't know that there were really hardly any that, as a philosophy, were against it. But, of course, if the private would come along and offer more than a co-op, then that's something different again.
Were this early co-op movement tied with politics? Was it a political, was it also in part a political movement?
Well, you had to have, in order to get these co-op laws, they don't drop out of the thin air, you know, so... Sure, they had to be politically powerful enough to get some things done, and they're still, I mean, it's still now, I mean, you know, still going on. Anytime the co-op tries to do something in the legislature, well, somebody's going to be against it, so
that's
just part of the deal.
Now, you mentioned one of your items, which is hugely important, of course, is milk marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier, I think you had said, during the Depression, for example, that the demand for milk, there was more supply than demand.
Mm-hmm.
And did you see that as a structural flaw or something that needed to be worked on?
Well, that's still true today. You know, milk prices today are so low that a lot of farmers are having trouble surviving. And, of course, that it's partly inherent in dairy farming itself. The auto industry, of course, has had all kinds of problems, but at least they can adjust their production. If the demand isn't there, they just don't produce cars. But in the agricultural field, that's a little different. I mean, they're producing this stuff, whether they're getting rid of it or not, and whether they're getting the price or not. So you have all these ebbs and flows. I mean, you go down through the years, and it's all you've got is you get a couple of years of good price and a couple of years of bad and up and down.
Uh-huh.
Right now, we're in a price depression, and milk prices are low, and farmers are having a big problem, and a lot of complaining, and a lot of political calls for political action is the other thing. And starting to improve a little bit, but it'll probably be another year before the prices get back up to somewhere close to what, you know, they can cover their production costs out of. So that's part of the problem, yeah.
And after World War II, with the big population bulge, I assume that dairy products became more in demand?
It wasn't so much more in demand. It was the fact that the market did improve, the incomes were higher, and it was also partly because of these programs like the Federal Milk Order Program and the Milk Price Support Program, even cooperative legislation, things like that. And also the fact that dairying made improvements in their, for instance, in transportation, and refrigeration, and also in bargaining, things like that, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the milk orders, if you will. At what point, when did they come in? When were the first milk orders in the country? Was that, I have no idea.
Okay, it came in 1937, as part of the Marketing Agreement Act of 1935, I believe it was, which provided the the authority for farmers to petition for a federal milk order, and then for the government to grant it if the evidence indicated that that it was warranted. And interestingly enough, the first federal milk order was right down in Chicago. And again, it sort of at least had partial impetus by all this activity here in Wisconsin in terms of trying to do something about their bargaining power.
Oh.
And under a federal milk order, well, again, you've had an evolution there. We have had continuous changes, and they're going on up even up to today.
Yeah.
But the idea there was that you would have a certain price that was mandated by the federal government based on the evidence and based on hearings for various classes of milk. There's class one is fluid, class two would be cream, class three would be butter, powder, and cheese. Although now they've got four classes. But at any rate, each class would have its own price.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the farmers could get a lot of their milk in a class one, their prices would be higher, but all backed up in a class three, they'd be lower. But by blending all three classes together and getting a blend price, well then at least they get some kind of a uniform price based on the combination of whether milk went into fluid or went into a manufacturing product.
When the government sets the milk order price, I know it's hugely complicated, but what are the basic principles by which they set these prices? Is it cost of production?
Yeah, it's part of that. It's trying to balance everything off where the government is supposedly, or at least theoretically, trying to set a price that is fair to the producers, fair to the consumer, and is fair to the handler. And part of it is in terms of trying to at least cover the farmer's cost of production, and also to recognize that because of the various elasticities of demand, that various products can vary in prices. In other words, milk is perishable, fluid milk is perishable.
Mm-hmm.
So if an individual wants to get fluid milk, that milk couldn't be more than 3 or 4 days old, or otherwise, you know, wouldn't be fluid milk anymore. You wouldn't be sure of the health aspects of it. So at any rate, because of the elasticity demand, they can set the price for fluid higher than they can for cheese and butter, because especially cheese, you can store that for years and then, you know. As a matter of fact, the older the cheese, sometimes the
more
better
money
it is.
They get for, right?
Yeah, so that was part of the, but again, it isn't just like the government, some guy sitting in Washington said, well, we're going to pay this, or we're going to set this or that or the other thing. They have to go through a hearing procedure.
Yeah.
They have all those testimonies, pro and con, has to be evaluated, has to be voted on. Now the farmers do the voting, the handlers do not have a chance to vote on it, but the farmers have to vote on it, and if they feel the price is too low, they might vote against it. But at any rate, it goes through a very long, matter of fact, some of these hearings go on sometimes for years, you know, before you finally get a decision in terms of what the price level is going to be.
Would it be somewhat fair to say that the government's trying to balance an acceptable price for the consumer and a profitable price for the farmer, and it's a real trick?
In theory, that's what is.
That's the idea.
That's the idea, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until the mid-1930s that these, so before that it was every man for himself.
Pretty much, yeah. That's what brought him on. That's what brought you. Well, as a matter of fact, both of you are too young to remember this, but we had milk strikes, and we even had some deaths associated with this whole proposition. Shawnee, Wisconsin, up there in northern Wisconsin, back in the early 30s, farmers unhappy about milk prices. There was milk strike where they were trying to block the milk from coming into the market, and got into a fracas up there, and well, they had the Battle of Cemetery Hill, Battle of Cemetery Hill. Every time I go into Shawnee, I think about that Battle of Cemetery Hill. You talk about the Battle of Bay Run or the Battle of Gettysburg,
yeah.
And we had our own little battle up there.
Explain it. Can you tell? did you actually witness it, or
no? I was too young.
But tell us about it.
Well,
please.
As I say, the farmers were on a milk strike, and some of them, you know, some of them were still sending milk, or at least trying to send milk. Others were on strike. The dealers were trying to get the milk, and the trucks were trying to come through, and the farmers were trying to block the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody gets run over, and somebody takes a shot, and pretty soon you got a big fracas going on.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's been others. That was, you know, back in, I guess that was back in the 30s, but we've had milk strikes.
Right.
Well, as a matter of fact, there was even been talk about milk strike just recently. I don't know if it really got very far, but,
yeah,
you know, it's that kind of thing, yeah.
Now, this is before the creation of the NFO.
The NFO came along in, it would have come along in the mid-60s,
oh,
yeah.
So let's wait for
right,
a
yeah. But again, the NFO was born out of that very same situation.
Yeah.
A group of farmers didn't feel they were getting enough for the product, and you got Orrin Lee Staley, you probably don't remember his name, but Orrin Lee Staley, a farmer he was from Kansas, I believe, but he set up his office in a little town in Iowa, right across the border.
Huh.
But anyway, he started out as a one-man operation with a part-time secretary, but he was a sort of an evangelist, and he'd go around and hold these meetings and talk to the farmers, and pretty soon the word got around. And I still remember when he came to Wisconsin, God, you'd have 500-600 farmers going to these meetings, and boy, he'd be talking away about what they ought to do and this, that, and he really got them going. So they organized the NFO, and it's still going. It's pretty well.
What was he preaching? Well,
he's preaching the fact that prices are too low. You guys aren't getting organized. You've got to get organized, and you've got to have a program, and you've got to go ahead in this program. You've got to have some teeth into it. And you know, he was a good talker, and he got them going. And eventually, of course, it got too big for him, and he eventually, I guess, either got canned or quit or what have you. But, I mean, he was a guy that,
yeah.
And that's kind of what, I mean, all these organizations, just it isn't just the NFO. Farmers Union got going that way. The Farm Bureau got going that way. They all got going because, you know, things aren't good, and you got to do something. You got to get organized. You got to have some representation, and so that's the history of agriculture.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds like the normal cry of dairy farmers. Things aren't good.
Well, you know, I shouldn't even tell this joke, but it's a joke, so I guess I can tell it.
Yeah, yeah.
That there's only one group of people in this world that are crying when they're born, they're crying while they're living, and they cry when they die. That's a farmer.
I mean, I bet if you could answer this question, you would win the Nobel Prize. But I'm going to ask it anyway. What's wrong with agriculture? I mean, all these things are trying to solve this basic problem of not getting enough money. Why is that?
Well, again, it gets back to the fact that you've got so many little individual units. Not, they aren't so little anymore,
yeah.
But they're still individual units, and they're competing in a massive marketplace, which now is not just Madison, Wisconsin, or the state of Wisconsin, or the U.S., it's the world. And even if a farmer's got 1,000 cows or 2,000 cows, what kind of a competitive position or bargaining position does he have? So you constantly got, and I know I started at the university in the early 50s, and I retired 25 years ago, and I still am involved today, and you're still talking about the imbalance between supply and demand. I mean, trying to get this thing balanced out. And everybody talks about supply control, but nobody wants to do it because they like to do it, but they want everybody else to be on the supply control, not themselves. I mean, that's pretty much the preference.
Right, they want everybody else to withhold milk but themselves.
Well, either withhold it or be on some kind of a program.
A program.
That, That has some teeth in it, yeah.
Right, so
I shouldn't denigrate it, but there's been attempts to do this, and some of them are fairly successful. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, like I said before, in Deering especially, it isn't quite as bad perhaps in some of these field crops, but in Deering, I mean, you've got these ups and downs. If it's going on for the last 50 years, and who knows, it's probably, may go on forever, I don't know.
Seems to me that the course that they should teach at Short Course is riding the roller coaster. I want to ask you in just a minute, I'm going to have to take a quick break, about your UW research. Mm. How are you doing for time?
Well, like I say,
You need to leave by 12 or before?
Well, I'd like to be home for lunch.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, okay. Let me, if you don't mind, it must be very good. Well, let me ask you that on the record here. The milk marketing order and all the legislation, was that seen as a big plank in the New Deal?
A big agricultural plank, yeah. Uh-huh. Right, yeah. Like I said before, it was authorized under the Agricultural Marketing Agreements Act of 1935, and that was the direct result of the New Deal. That was part of the New Deal agricultural legislation. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Was a lot of these things, the co-ops and the milk marketing orders, were these driven by Democrats? I mean, are there two kinds of farmers? Are there Republican farmers and Democrat farmers? Are they different?
Not when it comes to the paychecks. It's interesting that, and I don't want to name the organizations, but I mean, some of them rail against the government, but yet the farmers are all in these government programs, you know, so.
I know the organization to which you refer. Yeah, I won't mention it either. Right, okay. The NFO, I take it, was Democrat-oriented.
I would say the Democrats, well, it's just like today. I mean, they say all the Democrats are, they want to, you know, promote all these programs where the government's involved and stuff.
Right.
And Republicans say, no, we want more independence and so on and so on. So,
yeah.
You know, it's been going on forever. I guess that's why
75 years.
I guess that's why you have two parties, I guess.
I want to ask you about your particular research at the UW, and if you can kind of describe for us your sort of intellectual progress and the kinds of things that interest you at various times, and also mention, if you would, colleagues that were influential.
Okay, as far as the programs, they're sort of what I outlined earlier on. I got very involved in the Federal Milk Order Program. I've got all kinds of research in that, and have been involved in all kinds of committee meetings and legislative meetings and government meetings, farm meetings, what name you, because this Federal Milk Order is a constantly evolving procedure, because nothing is static in agriculture, as is true with life generally, but it's not static, so there's always something coming along, so you end up with like these various classes I was talking about, how some of them are higher priced. Well, there's always arguments about that, whether one's too high or one's too low. Then you had, how do you price these various classes? You had this Minnesota-Wisconsin pricing series, which reflected the price of manufacturing milk in Wisconsin, and they used that for the Class 3 price, and then they added differentials to get to Class 1 and 2. So so that was a big deal, because Wisconsin was more or less pricing the milk all over the country, because you start out with a base price here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and then you build off of that.
Oh.
So that went on for a long time.
Okay.
And now they've changed that to something different. But at any rate, it's stuff like that. And then you had the whole business about protein pricing, and you had hauling differentials, and you have quality differentials. And now you've got component pricing, which includes all the components of milk. Well, that's another thing. It started out with just price, the fat of the milk,
right.
And then, well, first of all, you were just pricing the milk, period. And
right.
Then Babcock came along, who's this eminent scientist here at the university,
right.
And he developed the Babcock test, so then you could separate the fat out, so they priced it on fat. And that worked all right for a while, because butter prices, kind of set the price for everything. But then when people started cutting back on butter and going to only a margarine, and the butter prices dropped and the fat prices are dropping. And then when World War II came along, I think I mentioned that to you one time, the first skim milk powder plant was built up at Union Center, Wisconsin, where they utilize the skim portion of the milk
oh.
and send the skim milk powder around the world for the troops. So then eventually, you know, the protein got to be valuable because everybody is interested in protein. So now it's sometimes the, well, even the whey, I talk about this whey coming down the creek, down the ditch
right.
next to us. Now whey is, you know, quite a, it can be very valuable. Of
yeah.
course, even that goes up and down. But there's been times when the only money made in milk was made out of the whey because, you know, other stuff was beat down and this whey is being made and everything under the sun. These buttons are made out of whey. Bread is made out, at least some bread is made. Medicine, you got whey in it. Whey is
wow.
a very, very highly nutritious product because it's very high in protein.
Right.
So, you know, you're utilizing every, or you're trying to utilize everything in that milk. It isn't just the fat or
and
the...
That's been a huge change in the industry.
Yeah, yeah, right. Actually, I was, well, that's another thing I was involved in when this whey started coming along. You know, what are you going to do about it? So I did quite a bit of work on that, made all kinds of studies and reports. And
when you do a study, you do an economics
yeah,
study, what's it worth, figuring
yeah.
out what it could
yeah,
be worth.
Right, yeah,
I
yeah,
see.
Yeah,
okay.
right, yeah. And then, of course, initially the whey wasn't really worth very much because nobody was utilizing it. It was being dumped out in the field or maybe fed to the hogs.
Right.
And, but then as industry became more cognizant of the nutrient value in a way, well, then they started being able to use it. And so now it's built right into the pricing system. You've got, you know, value for whey as well as a value for the fat, the non-fat, the protein, what have you.
So that's been a big change in,
mm-hmm.
in getting more for the every hundredweight of milk.
Well, getting as much as you can based on the composition of the milk. See, milk is there's a, in 100 pounds of milk, you've got roughly 88 pounds of water and roughly 12 pounds of solids.
Mm-hmm.
And in that solids, you've got maybe 3.5 pounds of butter fat,
mm-hmm.
and then you've got 8.5 pounds of solids not fat, and within that solids not fat, you've got perhaps half of that is protein, and then you get the lactose, and you got the riboflavin, you got the iron, you got magnesium, magnesium, you get everything under the sun in the non-fat, and that's all worth something. It's all being utilized.
Wow.
So, or at least
and
it should.
And you've seen that in your own lifetime.
Oh, yeah. See, the whey thing didn't come along until about the middle 70s. That's when it really started to, well, it was partly the result of the environmental push. Because initially, you could just dump it, well, like this case of
right.
on a farm. You dump in a ditch and it runs down next to somebody. Nowadays, of course, you can't have all that smell floating around, you know. So that was part of it, that you got these environmental laws that say, hey, wait a minute, you got to do something about this whey. You can't just dispose of it and let it. Matter of fact, I still remember when, you know, talking about Lake to Lake, they put their plant in Keel.
Uh-huh.
That was one of their plants in Keel, Wisconsin, which
yeah.
is right near where we live. And so there was a big battle about it because the authorities didn't feel that the Keel sewer system could handle all that whey. So Lake to Lake had to end up having to help finance a new sewage disposal system up there, expand the capacity of the sewage and also the water setup. So that,
right.
you know, that got an invention. And now, of course, it's, you know, just standard procedure. You know, if you're going to come in with something that's going to enter the water supply or the
yeah.
or
yeah,
the
yeah.
or the sewer supply or something, somebody's going to have to pay for it. So
the environmental concerns were the tail that wagged the dog in this case.
In the case of whey, that's pretty much what kicked it off. But then gradually, as technology improved and people got more cognizant about what was in that whey, then it took off.
All
and
right.
now you've got people running around trying to buy whey. So, you know.
Well, I'm amazed when you say that sometimes that's the most profitable part of the milk.
Yeah, well, it isn't always, but
no.
There have been times. There have been
uh-huh.
when the price for milk had beat down and they were still, you know, utilizing this whey for all these great uses, well, then at least you were getting something out of the whey anyhow, yeah. But again, even whey prices are, I remember I was actually involved in a lawsuit at one time where they brought me in as an expert witness, but there was a case where this involved an Ohio plant that had been trying to get rid of their whey up to, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, and so they'd worked out a deal with some disposal plant in Pittsburgh that they would take the whey just to get rid of it, more or less, you know, practically giving it
yeah,
away just
yeah.
to get rid of it. Well,
right.
then as whey got to be more and more valuable, then all of a sudden they said, oh, wait a minute, we don't think this is a very good deal. Well, you signed this contract, this is what you signed. Well, So that got to be a big hassle about how much that weigh was really worth, and it went to, it didn't, it never got to trial, but there were several, I was involved in a couple.
Very interesting. So that was your, that was your expertise, was pricing.
Yeah, it was
stuff.
Economics. It was economics. Yeah, I'm not a physical scientist.
Yeah, no, right.
Economics, yeah.
Apparently, you worked for the Center for Dairy Profitability?
No, I was not in this.
Okay.
That. As a matter of fact, that came along. Well, it was still there when I was there, but actually, Rick Clemmie, who is now one of the, he's an extension chancellor. He was the head of that for quite a while, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to, again, whenever it's time for you to jump up,
sure.
I want to talk, you to tell me about the sort of great personalities of the most influential people in Wisconsin dairying in your experience, people you knew in
mm-hmm.
particular.
Mm-hmm.
Who did the most for the dairy industry?
Well, I'll start right off with Rudy Froker. I don't know if that rings a bell
no,
or not.
No, I never heard of him.
Okay. Rudy Froker was one of the pioneers of the federal milk order system, and also a lot of these other issues in dairying. He started out in the Ag Econ department as an assistant professor, and he eventually rose to become the dean of the College of Agriculture. But he was one of the primary movers. Matter of fact, if anybody was responsible for the name Lake to Lake, it would have been Rudy, because he was involved in all these discussions, these farm meetings and what have you, and it got down to the point, well, what are we going to call this co-op? Well, they had these farmers organized from, or at least they were trying to organize them from Lake Winnebago to Lake Michigan.
Mm.
It was up in that area there along the border of Lake Michigan and in Manitowoc County, Calumet County, Winnebago County up there. So he said, well, this is farmers from Lake Michigan to Lake Winnebago. Lake to Lake, that sounds like a good name. Okay, that, I mean, that isn't me contribution to life, but, you know, it was that kind of thing.
It's a
you
good
know.
One.
Yeah, but at any rate, then in addition to that, he and a fellow by the name of Cliff Hardin, who, again, you may not remember, but Cliff ended up being the Secretary of Agriculture, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture.
Oh, wow.
But he came into Wisconsin also as a young professor, and at that time, Rudy Froker was a full professor. But anyway, the two of them worked on a new pricing plan for milk, the fat, solids, not fat pricing plan. The fat and solids, not fat pricing plan.
Okay.
I had mentioned before that up until about the 1950 or so, the milk had all, well, I shouldn't say the 50, but at least in World War II, up to World War II, the price of milk had always been priced just strictly on a fat basis. And Froker and Hardin developed a procedure which was called the fat and solids not fat pricing procedure, where they would figure out not only what the value of the fat was, but also what the value of the solids not fat was. So this, and that's actually what I, when I first came to the university, and Froker had then become dean, he had told me that that's what I should be working on, and that's what I started working on.
Is that right?
So I had hundreds of meetings with farmers all over the state, probably thousands, I don't know, explaining this fat and solids not fat pricing plan. Well, maybe it doesn't sound like a heck of a lot, but you see, again, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. And when they were strictly on fat, the high fat producers, the Guernseys, the producers, or the Jerseys, they were getting a pretty good price for their milk because it was all based on the fat. Well, then when they go into fat and solids not fat, well, then all of a sudden the lower testing milk, you're getting some credit. Your fat value is lower, but at least you're getting some for your non-fat. So that kind of switched around the whole structure of how you price milk. And
did it change the affection for different breeds in Wisconsin?
I think to a certain extent it did, because at one time, now we got something over 90% of the milk is Holstein.
Right.
And at that time it was probably 50-50, something like that. So
really?
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's not just because you change the pricing procedures, because you're crediting, you know, the solids not fat for all these values in protein and riboflavin and iron and everything under the sun.
And
so
was this a
lactose?
Was it a difficult concept to explain to farmers?
Well, there's various bulletins written on it, and I've written some myself.
Yeah.
So there, in other words, you evaluate what the values of these different components are, and then that then becomes the basis for pricing for the milk. But again, like I say, you know, if somebody's facing with a change and they aren't sure how they're going to come out, they aren't all excited about it. So you've got to, you know, explain this. But gradually it's gone in.
Yeah.
Same thing happened when you went into protein pricing. Now we're pricing milk and protein in addition to just the, it is no longer just solids, not fat. It's the protein. The protein in that solids, not fat, that's getting priced. And again, that changed stuff because now you test for protein.
And
all
the
milk
genetics.
All milk is not, I mean, you got all kinds of variations in protein,
right.
Just like you have variations in fat, and just like you had variations in solids, not fat. So.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And that actually changes the genetic pool of the herd, of the state herd.
Well, again, you know, people are going to try to breed
yeah.
and feed for, you know, whatever, you know, you get the most dollars out of it.
Okay,
yeah.
right,
mm-hmm.
of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those are some influential people. Any
oh, okay, well, yeah. I just named, yeah,
well,
for Carnard.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say Truman Torgerson was very influential.
Because of Lake to Lake.
Well, yeah, and then he was also a leader in everything under the sun. God, he was president of just about everything.
Really?
When he was in his prime, yeah, he was chairman, or he was president of Federation of Co-ops, and he was on the board of Land O'Lakes, and
God.
I don't know, everything under the sun, you know.
So if there were a Nobel Prize, you know, for dairying, these guys would get it?
Well, Nobel Prize, that's...
You know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, Froker certainly would rank very high, and I'm sure Torgy would rank very high.
Uh-huh.
Of course, guys like Babcock, you know, you've got to hand,
oh, yes.
hand it to God.
He gets to be a
yeah.
saint.
Yeah, right, right. Connie Elvium, who was president here, he was
okay.
very, very high. Yeah, yeah.
How about influential dairy farmers? You know, were any, you know, these are all university people, that's
mm-hmm.
fine.
Mm-hmm.
Any dairymen who stand out, who should be awarded our prize?
Well, again, this name, probably you've never heard it, but one of the people that was very instrumental in forming Lake to Lake, which again led to the impetus for a lot of other development,
uh-huh.
was Art Murphy. He was a farmer,
okay.
lived up around up around Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I can still remember going to meetings where Art would get up and kind of like Orrin Lee Staley later on. You know, the guy had a facility for talking and explaining stuff, getting down to the farm level where people could relate to him. So Art was very influential.
Okay.
There are others. There were people like George Ruppel, who helped organize the Consolidated Badger Co-op, which now has been merged into, they've gone through a couple of mergers, but they're ending up now in what used to be the Wisconsin Dairy Co-op, which is now Foremost.
Mm-hmm.
George Ruppel was a big name.
Okay.
The fellow that really got Land O'Lakes going, I can't think of his name right off the bat, but he started out, he in effect started Land O'Lakes he started out up in some little city up in, town up in Minnesota, and he got organized to send butter to New York City. It was a local co-op that, again, had been, they felt being disadvantaged in what they were getting, so he got it organized, so they started moving butter to New York City directly from this plant.
Oh.
Thief Falls, Minnesota, I believe, is where that, and I just can't think of his name.
That's all right.
But anyway, he was also a prime mover in agriculture.
Right. Okay.
Mel Sprecher was another very influential farmer. He organized the Wisconsin, or at least he was one of the organizers of the Wisconsin Dairies Co-op right up here it's right outside of Baraboo,
yeah.
yeah. So it was people like that. Yeah.
What would you what would you nominate as the two or three or whatever most important technological changes that influenced the dairy industry the most in your lifetime?
The Babcock test certainly is one of
yes,
them.
Yes, of course.
I would say also probably the protein, testing for protein.
Right,
I think
that's
very, very important. This isn't really a technology, but bulk tank procurement, you know, used to haul it off in these 80-pound cans, and of course you have them sitting around the milk house, and and try to keep them cool and all that kind of stuff. But then you got in a bulk tank where you have the bulk tanks and the milk goes into the bulk tank right from the cow and it's cooled properly and then it's siphoned right into a truck and hauled into the factory and processed into product or sold as fluid milk. I think bulk tank was quite important. Well, the whole business about transportation itself, the sanitation, that was one thing that inhibited the dairy industry for quite a while, that you had to move this milk close. Well, that's why you had all these little corner cheese factories and everything under the sun. Now, I mean, you can bypass all that and move it down to Florida if you have to. I mean, a lot of milk goes right from here down to Florida, you know, in a tank truck.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, during the year. See, there's another thing. We have these flushes during the year. Your flushes in the spring when there's the most milk, and then your bottom of it is in the fall. And so Florida runs Florida, and some of these southern markets run low on milk, and so we're taking milk like mad down to Florida for quite several months in the fall. So, but again, you can't do that unless you have, you know, the trucks that are sanitized and cool,
and
highway system, that kind of stuff. So,
would you say that it's a lot easier or somewhat easier to be a farmer today?
Well, I don't know that it's easier in some respects, and I think it's more difficult in others.
Huh.
It certainly is easier in terms of the physical labor, because, you know, when I was a kid, and I'm not bragging, but I mean, you did an awful lot of work, and I mean, it was pretty much all end to end, you know, like, well, just like shocking this grain and hauling it and running it through the threshing machine, cutting the hay and putting into a winnow row and then going along with a hay loader and loading into the hay load and then dumping it up in the mall and you got to pull it apart and all that kind of stuff. Milking cows, milking them by hand compared to, you know, so in that sense it's easier. But on the other hand, you've got to be so much more adroit in the financial aspects and then, well, like computers. I mean, if you got 1,000 or 1,500 cows, you better know something about computers or you're probably going to be in a big mess. So you got to be more technological knowledgeable now than you were when, you know, before all these things came along. So
you need
it's
a better business brain.
Yeah, you've got to be, that's right. You've got to be better trained as a businessman now in order to survive. And of course that can be a big advantage because that can really help you improve your economic status, you know. Right?
So intellectually it's more difficult. You know what I mean intellectually? I mean in terms of what you have to think about.
Well, I think that's why I guess, you know, you were questioning me why I came to college. Well, at that time, you know, you didn't think that much about it. But again, I mean, I'm not saying that the only people that are successful have to go to college, but it's part of this training that you need in order to, you know, really compete in the modern world, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is it hard, do you think, to be a high school graduate dairy farmer today or maybe in 20 years?
There could be, but even there, like you talk about short course, a lot of these kids are coming down your short course and they don't necessarily have to go to 4 years, but a lot of them do. But yeah, you can get, and also there are that you can go to vocational school, you know, vocational school, sure. And there's some private places too, but it would be harder to just learn this all on your own. You'd have to have somebody that, some structural way of observing these things.
I'm going to let you go. I have one more question. Maybe Marcia has some questions, and then I'll let you go for sure. What would you think the dairy industry in Wisconsin will be like 20 years from now? Can you make any predictions?
I think it's going to be a progressive evolution from where we are today, which has been a terrific evolution from the way it was 70 years ago. But let's face it, and we're going to have bigger and bigger herds. We're going to, well, look at, when I was on the farm and even later on in the beginning years, I mean, you're talking about 30 cows, 40 cows. I mean, God, you couldn't survive. I mean, you can't raise a family with 30, 40 cows. There's just no two ways about it. That's why we're getting, right now the average size of herd here in Wisconsin, I guess, is around something over 100 now. And it's probably even higher than that. It's probably 150. We got a lot of herds here in Wisconsin. There are 1,000 cows.
Right.
And out in California, you got 2,000, 3,000. Out there, you got a factory. You got a factory farm. I doubt we'll go to a factory farm here because we're different. You know, we have better facilities for raising things. We have the land and all that kind of stuff. But certainly, the farms are going to keep getting bigger and bigger. They're going to get more and more mechanized. They're going to get more and more computerized. They're going to be more and more specialized. You know, it's that sort of thing that's going to keep going on.
Do you think that in this great rush, necessary rush for progress in the years you've seen in the future, that we will, do we lose anything? You know what I mean? Satisfaction, something?
I think we probably lose some. Well, we certainly lose. We at least we have a change in life, that's for sure. And some of it could be a lot better. For instance, like you say, when I was a kid on the farm, you'd go to high school and say, oh, you're a kid from the farm. Well, now the kids from the farm probably probably as good as anybody. But I mean, you used to go to a meeting, you'd see all these people in bib overalls and wearing hats and all that kind of stuff. Now you go to a meeting, I mean, these farmers look just like anybody else. You know, they're dressed up and they know what's going on and they dress nicely. And plus, they're smart, at least the ones that, you know, are fairly successful, they know that there's no, that bragging on the day you die that you never missed a milking is not going to help you. So they go on vacation once in a while and try to live a regular life, you know. So I think those are the sort of things that are happening.
That's very interesting. Marcia, do you have any questions?
Just two.
For Mr. Graff.
Okay. You served in the military,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, that's right.
Could you just, that's the first thing, could you just tell us a little bit about that? And the second thing is, Bob Kraut brought up a statement about, on one occasion somebody called the university to have you fired over an issue.
Well, that was the NFO. That was the NFO.
That
was what? I'm sorry. What got you almost fired?
The NFO.
Oh, the NFO.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I
see.
The processor.
The
private processor.
Well, the NFO, as I mentioned before, started somewhere in, I think, the late 60s, something
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Orleans Steele going around and, you know, getting farmers' interest, what have you. But anyway, they came along with this, they eventually developed this plan of theirs, which was going to try to elevate the price of milk, and you have to give them credit for that. But at any rate, their plan was that they would get control of about 20 or 30% of the milk, and they would set a price on it, and that was what they were going to get. And if the dealer didn't want to buy it, well, okay, they wouldn't sell it to the dealer, and on that basis, they'd gradually pull all the prices up to its whatever level they'd set, which was substantially higher than what the farmers are getting. Well. So there was a lot of interest in this. Now, what is this? Is this a good plan or is it a bad plan? So I was asked to make an analysis of this plan, and I did that, and I presented my findings, and I pointed out some of the flaws in that plan, that you're just not going to be able to jack the prices up in Wisconsin because you've got interstate commerce, and you can't possibly have a higher price in Wisconsin than you have in Iowa and Illinois because the milk is going to flow in, and you know, eventually you're going to end up with something else. And there were some other issues to it, but it was essentially that you can't artificially jack the price up in one area without there being an impact on it. Well, I was asked to present this to all kinds of meetings, which I did, and of course, the NFOs didn't like it, and there was a lot of, I still remember one case up in Marshall, Wisconsin. They were having this big farm meeting up there, and they wanted me to talk on this thing. So I guess the NFO had called it, actually. So I went up there. The meeting was at night. I think it started at 8 o'clock. And so at any rate, I presented this thing. I had all these slides and everything under the sun, and there were a lot of questions. And so it finally broke up at about 10 o'clock, and I wanted to get home that night, you know. Well, in those days, we had what was a big view graph machine. You don't have this PowerPoint like you have now where you can carry it under one arm. This massive thing that weighed about 150 pounds or something. And so anyway, I had this thing and I was walking out of the hall and some woman got a hold of me, some farm wife, and I mean, she just lit into me. And I should have done it, but I was holding this darn view graph because I thought as long as I hold it, maybe she can get the idea that I can get the heck out of here. Well, she just kept going for about a half an hour. And I finally got out of there, but my arm was a darn sore. It took me a couple of weeks to recover from that thing. So at any rate, it was that kind of an intense feeling at the time. And
wow.
you know, I mean, they had their feelings, and they said, well, you know, you're not trying to help the farmers, you're not working for farmers. And I said, look, I'm a farmer myself. I grew up on a farm, but this thing is not going to work. Well, eventually they did other things, but
right.
that was part
Very
of the deal. Yeah, yeah. And then as far as the military, yeah, I came down here in 39, and then, of course, Pearl Harbor happened in 1941, December of 41. And so I enlisted in the Navy Air Corps, and so I was in the flying airplanes during the war, yeah.
You flew, what sort of planes did you fly?
Dive bomber, SB-2C dive bomber, yeah.
In Europe or Japan?
No, I never had to go overseas,
oh.
Fortunately. I was in training and got all my, I got my wings, and
wow.
But then the war was over, so then I came back to college, yeah.
Wow.
But then after the war was over, then I went into the reserve program. I went into Naval Intelligence. And so I put in about 30 years in the reserve program.
Wow.
Finally retired in 1972, I think,
wow.
From the Navy.
Cool.
Hmm.
Marsh, any more?
Well, there it is.
Mr. Graff, anything you'd like to add? And again, we can continue this at some other time if you feel like it, but is there anything you'd like to sort of
Well,
sum
I think
up?
You've asked all the questions, and hopefully I
Good.
Tried to cover
the questions
them.
Were good. The answers were good. I'll turn it off then.
Sure.
Okay.
I thought of one other person that I mean, there's so many people you could probably mention that I hate to even start.
Yes, of
course. But Lyman McKee, and again, I don't know if that name rings
no,
a bell.
Afraid not.
Lyman had a farm right outside of Madison. It's now part of Fitchburg Development.
Oh.
But at any rate, Lyman was the instigator or the pioneer in developing the dairy promotion program in Wisconsin.
Wow.
They call it the American... They call it the, I forget what they call it then, but now it's part of, now it's a national program. At that time, he ran around and with his group, he got them going, where they would run around to the farmers and say, hey, you contribute, I think it was several cents a hundredweight at the time, then we'll use this money to promote your products, and then hopefully that'll bring, you know, the more sales, which
yeah,
can
yeah.
eventually help the price level. So he got that going in Wisconsin. It was strictly voluntary. For about probably 30 years or so, and then gradually it got into the realm of legislation. So then they passed a law where it became mandatory. So now we have a 15-cent deduct from the milk check for promotion, and that's used for, as a matter of fact, Brian Gould, who is a member of the Ag Econ Department, he is now employed partly by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board, which in turn is funded through this dairy marketing checkup
right,
of 15
right,
cents
right.
a hundredweight. So that's, Lyman, you have to give him credit for
yeah.
being one of the forerunners too. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, June is Dairy Month, is that part of that?
Well, see, that was part of Lyman's idea too. Well, he and others have June as Dairy Month, and so then you really plug dairy products in June. Well, we still have June as Dairy Month, but now it's a 12-month program, you know, really.